guest, Tony Russo. Thanks for coming on, buddy.
Absolute pleasure.
Now, Tony, you are a very interesting person. You're a journalist, an author, a podcaster. You've had your hand in various media businesses over the years. But today you're here to talk about your latest book called Dragged Into the Light, which is about truthers, reptilians, super soldiers, and death inside an online cult. And yes. Oh boy, am I excited for this conversation. So thank you for coming on.
I'm delighted to be here. I love to talk about this stuff. I'm trying to get the word out only because I've been steeped in it for almost 2 years now, and I need someone to talk to about it.
Well, that sounds good. That's what I'm here for. So tell us a little bit about it. How did you get started on this work? What exactly is it about? And then we'll get into some of the details.
Sure. So I got started as essentially an assignment. I had been working on a podcast that is called This Is War, and I'd been interviewing combat veterans about their combat experiences, turning each of their stories into, a narrative. And that show ended up getting canceled. And I was just looking for something else to work on. And one of my colleagues said, have you heard of this Jerry Schreiner reptile thing? And I said, no. But then I started to look into it, and it was so compelling that I put aside the other story that I had been toying with and set myself to find out as much about this cult and the deaths around it as I could.
Right. It is I've looked into it, and I've checked out Sherry Schreiner's website and, her blog and all that kind of stuff. And it's a very interesting domain, shall we say, of people. And, we're not here to shit on anyone or to offend people. We're just sort of going about talking, seeing what it's like, for people who are on that side of the fence, we could say, or who are trying to find answers in places that, maybe there's some answers, maybe they're good, maybe they're not so good, but there's a wide variety of humans that roam the earth today. And I guess if you're you're a follower of Sherry Schreiner, you believe some of them are reptiles and some of them are aliens, and there's a whole list of possibility that goes out there.
Well, I like the way you put that, because it is my intention, has been my intention, to not just hold these people up for ridicule. My concern and what I'd like to write about, and what I've been writing, I write blogs about it now, what I've been talking about, is just laughing at them isn't helping. We have to find a way to understand that these are their real beliefs, and while I don't think we should accept them at all, we just can't keep treating these people like kooks. As I said, the January 6th insurrection here in the U.S. was, those were regular people, and those were people that we laughed at, and they're much less funny when they're armed and storming the seat of government than they are when they're just, making rude comments online.
Right. And I suppose there's an important distinction between, figuring out what people believe and, to a large degree, allowing people to have their beliefs, whatever they are, even if they're seem outlandish or they're different from our own. But, when it comes down to it, they're just people, and they have reasons for believing this or that. And it does take a bit of a turn when, actions, start to be taken, and particularly violent actions, never a good thing. And that's where things get a little bit more messy, right? Is it's not just having thoughts about something.
Exactly. And unfortunately, that can be the case with any, religious belief. It's not, there's a fine line between this is what I believe and this is what you have to believe. Yeah. And this notion that we all have to get our beliefs together, or that we should be legislating, religious and metaphysical beliefs, that's concerning. Like, because you believe it doesn't mean I should have to act on it. especially in the case of, again, metaphysical things like spirituality and God, broadly speaking. You know, one of the things I always like to remind people when they say, you know, when they want to kind of make fun of, you know, some of the Sherry Shriner's beliefs, I always say, you know, most places in the U.S., you can't buy, many places in the U.S., you can't buy liquor on Sundays, you know, and it's a small thing, but it's an important thing. Like, we think that it's perfectly okay to close down liquor stores because it might hurt God's feelings, and that's normal. But to think that there are reptiles trying to overthrow the government or running the government, that's weird. And that's, again, once you start to critique metaphysics, you have to go all the way to the bottom, which is, it's not a fight that I'm interested in having, but it's an aspect of it that I really like to point out.
Yeah, and I think that's important. Is it's like, well, it's not, you know, you can look at other people's beliefs and you can be like, that shit's crazy, or that's so weird, or why do you believe that? But if you sort of take the time to examine your own beliefs, you'll probably find a few of those that are, you're like, this is why, I mean, what am I doing? Like, this is strange. You know, it's not that different. It's just, I mean, it's perhaps the content of your belief is different, but the, you know, intent behind it is the same, right? Which is that you're just trying to understand things.
Exactly. The evidence behind it is also the same, which is you want to believe it. The things that we believe are the things that we want to believe. And what I'm really interested in is that idea. Why do you want to believe these things? Because that's the real question. The question isn't, you know, isn't how come YouTube is profiting off of these people who are looking for reptilians, I think. I think the question is, why are people looking for reptilians, right? And when you take that step back, that why do you believe what you believe, why does it make you happy to believe what you believe? That's a question that a lot of people have trouble answering, and not just reptilians.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, to be human is a very strange thing. And there's a lot of things that we don't understand, or that we want answers for, or that we, you know, need answers for in some sense, because not having answers is so unnerving and unsettling. And
absolutely.
So it's easy to understand why people would be inclined to, you know, follow a teaching of someone who is saying, listen, I have the answers. Here they are. They might sound a bit outlandish to you, but let me tell you why I think this is the case. And, you know, a bunch of people will be like, oh, that makes sense. I agree with that. And I mean, many won't, you know, inevitably, but that's okay, because not everyone will agree on everything. But it certainly, you know, and particularly, you know, not to be disparaging, but it's like, well, who are the people who get involved in cults of various sorts? And that there are sort of everyday people, you know, you probably met a bunch of them on the street, or they're friends or family, or, you know, they're not like a different species. They're just looking for answers, and they, for whatever reason, found someone who's giving answers, and something about that resonates with them, right?
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
And so Sherry is one of the examples of a person who, you know, sort of goes about teaching what she believes to be the case, and has developed a significant following of people who, you know, see her as a messenger or a teacher or whatever it is. And then, you know, once you're kind of sold on the person, then the beliefs are a little bit easier to get in line with.
Yes, absolutely. I would quibble only with, I don't think Sherry believes any of this.
You don't?
I think she's a con artist. So that's...
What makes you say that?
Well, several things. The first is the money aspect. I mean, she made a really, really good living doing this. But the second is, having read more of her writings and works than I can even... begin to, I certainly wouldn't wish having to do this much reading and listening on my worst enemy. It's not just a contradiction. It's, I mean, because there's going to be contradictions in lots of religious beliefs, but it is this kind of malleability that plays to the crowd without them really noticing it. One of the things that I think I mentioned in the book, but it's certainly something that I've talked about a lot with when I'm talking about Sherry, is she was virulently anti-Trump, and her anti-Trump messages just weren't getting any traction. And so she switched to being more pro-Trump because that's what kept the money coming in. So this isn't a person who's operating on beliefs. This is a person who's operating on a marketing plan that has to do with satisfying her listeners and her donors more than what God is or isn't telling her.
That's very interesting because, you know, you can certainly understand why one would do that, right? Is if you're making a living of being a speaker of sorts and you have an audience and you will cater, it makes sense why you would cater to the audience to keep them. And, you know, I guess you try out certain things and then some resonate with the audience and some don't. And then whatever does resonate with your audience, you kind of lean in, right? Because that's how it's going to keep you going.
Correct, but that's certainly different from doing the Lord's work.
Yes.
Which is kind of delivering this absolute truth that she claims to deliver. That's where it gets dicey. I've given this example before. I think of Alex Jones, and I am in no way defending Alex Jones, but you think of Alex Jones having just being this, you know, kind of madman on AM radio. And all of a sudden, he goes from, you know, struggling to get by to being very wealthy, to having a national voice. And, you know, it comes from people laughing at him. And then all of a sudden, he's got this national voice. And he can't just then back down and say, well, I was just making it all up, because, you know, he has to double down on it or quit.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of these. Yes. Yes.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, that's what I was saying. I think it happens to a lot of minor league scammers who go viral or who go pro or who get big. They're trapped. They're as much trapped by it as their followers are, because Alex Jones isn't going to quit and then go get a job at, you know, Walmart. You know, I mean, this is what he does. So it's what he has to do. And again, I don't feel any pity for him whatsoever, but it's certainly a better explanation than that he really believes it.
Right. And it makes sense what you're saying about how, you know, once you've established a market audience, right, and you want to keep it going, like, you can't just do a 180 on what you've been saying, because then you'll lose your audience. And, you know, listen, it all comes down to choices, right? Like, you could do that and see how it goes, and you'll maintain maybe a fraction of your audience, but you'll get to, you know, speak what you believe is true, or you can take a different route and just keep with what's working and, you know, go for it that way. And I mean, there's, you know, consequences either way. We're not here to judge people or say that they should or shouldn't do this, or that's this and right and wrong. We're just kind of looking at what's happened and seeing what happens with it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What we can learn from it. And there's tons of interesting stories. I mean, you said you spent 2 years researching this Sherry Schreiner stuff, and you've spoken to a number of the people who are followers and, you know, had conversations and gotten really good insight on what's been going on. And so it's interesting to hear you say that, like, you can see that she tends to play to the audience, so to speak, right?
Yes.
While at the same time, you know, professing a sort of ultimate truth, whereas you would, if someone were in a position to be like, okay, I know the truth, right? I'm going to say it, and then it doesn't matter what people think. And
exactly.
If I have a following, so be it. If not, so be it. There's no like, what do I say to keep the following or to, you know, make the most amount of the following happy or content or
right.
whatever it is.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
But so, you know, let's go to the beginning right
okay.
now. How did Sherry Schreiner start this organization or
well,
whatever you would
Sherry,
like to call it?
Sherry had gone to school. She was hoping to be kind of like a conservative talking head on CNN. And this is back in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. So she went to Liberty University, which is famous for being, Jerry Falwell runs, that's his college. So he was one of the founders of what was called the Moral Majority in the 1980s. And they were the people who figured out that the conservatives could be taken over because of with religious overtones. And so they kind of weaponized their followers and these are, you know, conservative Christians and what I want to say, like normal, what you would think of as normal ones, like just Baptists or, you know, conservative Lutherans, even conservative Catholics who they could manipulate into moving their agenda forward. And she was really, really interested in that. And she thought that she could do well, and she didn't. Is just the short version of it is she ended up having to go back home where she got married and started having kids. And as far as I could tell, never had like a real straight job after that, but was doing a lot of multi-level marketing type stuff, work from home type stuff, try to make money on the internet in 1997 kind of.
Wow.
I don't know if you're old enough to recall, but that was always a big thing, you know, buy this program and you can make money on it on the internet. That was
right.
huge in the late 90s and at the turn of the century. What ended up happening was were the 9/11 attacks. And after the 9/11 attacks, Sherry bought a computer program called the Bible Code. And this was a thoroughly debunked notion that the Bible contained secret messages that were prophecy. And the gentleman who invented the Bible Code was actually an atheist. And his name is Michael Drosnin. And what he said was that the Bible was actually written by time-traveling aliens. And, you know, they left these codes for us to understand, to be able to see into the future if we wanted. Mm-hmm. And he had quite an amount of success, but the Bible Code program took away the difficulty of having to be able to read ancient Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
So you could type my name in, you know, Tony Russo, and it would show where Tony Russo appeared in the Bible, and then you could prophesize about me based on what passages in the Bible my name appeared. And Sherry took that and built her own kind of take on Christianity on that. And she added bits and pieces of different religions and different practices along the way. And by 2010, she had a pretty strong following on Yahoo groups. And when Facebook started to blow up in 2010, she made her move over there, where she found even more success.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how a program like the Bible Codes, you know, can be used in so many different ways, right?
Yes.
Particularly open-ended concepts like prophecies, where there's somewhat of a string of truth that you can latch onto and then, you know, do with it what you will. And, you know, I've noticed that like one of her, not her specifically, but often people in these sort of like big positions of leadership and power in the, you know, I guess it's quasi-religious groups. It's like, there's the message of like, I have the message, right?
Right.
I know how to read the Bible. I know how to do this. Let me show you, or let me tell you, right?
Exactly.
And you, I mean, you know, with there is that in religion in general, and to some degree that's fine, and you know, you have experts in certain fields. I mean, even in science, it's like, yeah, you, if you want to know what's happening in the brain, you go to a neuroscientist and they'll be like, let me tell you what's happening, because that's what they do, right? I mean, it's not exactly the same, but it's a little bit, because it's like, well, there's experts and you kind of figure out which experts you want to trust.
That's the trick.
To give their opinion on things.
Absolutely, right? That's the trick.
But the internet's a very interesting phenomenon, because with enough people, anyone can develop a following for anything, right? You just have to be consistent and put in the time and the effort, right?
Correct.
And so if you manage to recruit one out of, I don't know, 1,000 people, let's say, will listen to you, then you just need to somehow expose yourself to, let's say, 1,000,000 people, and you'll have 1,000 followers just like that, right?
Correct. Yes.
And they'll be like legit, right? It's not fake. It's like, no, they, for whatever reason, think that what you have to say is important. And I mean, podcasts aren't entirely different. Just the messaging is different, right? It's like, you know, for me, like, I don't have a truth that I'm trying to tell people or whatever it is. I'm like, no, I just want to have interesting conversations that people might want to listen to, and try to find the people who are interested in that, right?
Yes.
So I guess the difference is just the overall message of what I'm trying to achieve, or what she's trying to achieve.
And the actions that you expect people to take on your behalf. That's,
yes,
you know,
which for me is zero. I don't want people.
I want people to
anything.
buy a book on my behalf. I'll come right out and say it.
Fair enough. And I guess I want people to listen to the podcast.
But, there you go. But
other than that, I'm like, listen. Also, I'm like, if you don't like it, don't listen. Like, that's cool.
And certainly don't force other people to listen.
No. And I certainly don't, that's an interesting one, where it's like, if you don't listen, you know, then you're going to burn in hell or something like that.
Right.
But so, and listen, you know, the sort of side of conspiracy theories, just to sort of take it on a different track, is it's interesting, because it's like, conspiracy theories are only conspiratorial in nature until they are proven to be true. And then it becomes quote unquote facts. Right.
Yeah, I would hedge a little bit on that, because there are no reptile overlords. There's there's no global cabal running things. We have a lot of wealthy people, and we have a lot of powerful people, and those wealthy and powerful people will cheat where they can to remain wealthy and powerful. And sometimes they talk to one another about how they can cheat to remain wealthy and powerful. But the coordination that it takes for some conspiracies to be real is just too much. The word is always going to get out. And rather than investigate whether or not a conspiracy is true, what I say to people is, maybe check to see whether the effects of the conspiracy can even be decided, right? Like, if you think that the government is, you know, if you think that the president is a reptile, like, there's not much conversation we can have about that, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, what would it take for you to be convinced that the president wasn't a reptile? If you're not going to be open to being wrong, then you shouldn't investigate conspiracies. You know, your idea isn't to debunk or to believe, but literally to investigate and to set out the parameters for investigation. You know, if you think there's a conspiracy, you have to, the second question would be, okay, well, what would be proof of the conspiracy? Not what evidence can I find that the conspiracy is true, but what would count to a reasonable person as proof of a conspiracy?
The conspiracy that I like to talk about when this question comes up, because it inevitably does, is there's a the story is maybe a year and a half old now, or 2 years old now, but you know, the company Exxon conspired to make people think that recycling worked. That is, you know, that's a demonstrated conspiracy. They found the evidence of Exxon saying, well, we know people have stopped buying plastic. This was back in the late 80s or early 90s. They realized that people were moving to more glass and were buying less plastic. And that meant that, you know, the petroleum that gets made into plastic was less valuable. So they initiated, and they spend tens of millions of dollars a year in support of recycling programs, but they knew that the recycling programs couldn't work because no one wants recycled plastic for their new products. And so the numbers on the bottom of, you know, they have numbers on the bottom of recyclables. They're completely fictitious. You know, it was just to make people feel better about buying plastic as long as they recycled. And, you know, that's a genuine conspiracy. And, you know, Exxon actually commented on it. They said, well, we really thought we would have had it licked by now, but they don't. Right. And so they're working on, according to the spokesperson that they spoke with in this story, they're working on, they feel like they're closer to making recyclables possible. But for now, they're just frankly not. The amount
of
plastic.
So what happens to all the recycled plastic?
Much of it just ends up in landfills. There are warehouses filled for when the plastic market goes up and down. You know, there is a small market for recyclable plastics.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
You're right.
I spoke too long.
No?
There's a small market for recyclable plastics, but not in proportion to the plastic that we use. And in, there never could have been. Yes.
So you're saying it's not that that plastic can't be recycled. It's just that the
it isn't recycled.
End product, yeah, or that it's like not as well recycled as people think.
Right. By getting us to focus on recycling rather than on not buying plastic, Exxon bought itself 30 years of selling plastic that it knew it couldn't recycle.
Mm-hmm. So what happens now then? With like, what about
now we
like
keep
paper
buying plastic
and that.
Well, paper and metal and all of those are real. It's just the plastics that aren't recycled.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah.
You brought up this point to say
that's a conspiracy. That's a legitimate conspiracy, right? And if somebody said, I think there's a conspiracy to try to get us to recycle and research the recycling process, they would find that that's true, and that's demonstrable.
Okay,
but just saying, you know, that recycling is a plan for government control, you're not going to find evidence of that. You can't find evidence of that. That as evidence doesn't exist. So the way that you go about investigating what people tend to refer to as conspiracies is the only thing that matters. And why you want to investigate them. That's the most important. Like, why do you want to investigate whether or not the president is a lizard? Like, you have to answer that question first before you start investigating.
Right. And I suppose it's also relevant the kind of evidence that you're looking for or will use to prove or disprove something.
Right.
And, you know, sort of just in the normal scientific method of investigation, it's like, well, you know, the what do they call it, like there's certainly self-fulfilling prophecies, and
yes,
you know, you can find evidence for things if you're looking for it, but it doesn't mean that that evidence will be, you know, objective and can be peer-reviewed and proven. And necessarily it's like, well, if you're looking for evidence for something, you can find it. But
correct,
it doesn't mean it's exactly what you think it is, right?
And I made this point in an earlier draft, and my sister-in-law, who was reading the book for me, you know, I got an editor, but she was just reading it, you know, as a reader. What do you think? She
I talked about the difference between evidence and proof because they're not the same thing. And she said, I mean, I hadn't made it clear in the first draft and I cleared it up, but that's something that it's important to remember is, you know, evidence is interpreted in conjunction with other evidence. And it's not if, for example, to go back to the reptilians, if someone on television looks like a reptile, I guess that's evidence that they might be a reptile, but it's certainly not proof that they are a reptile.
Right. Or if they act certain ways.
Right. It could be evidence that they might be, but it's not proof that they are. And I think a lot of people confuse evidence with proof too often. And that's something that we could all benefit from as we, you know, as we go about our lives on the internet.
Yeah, trying to decipher what's real and what's not. I mean, with the amount of information that's accessible today, it's so difficult to know what to believe anymore, you know? And because it seems to be the case that, you know, whatever news outlet you're watching, it's like, well, yeah, but they also have some agendas. And it's not necessarily evil, but it's like, well, no, but they're trying to make the most money, or they're trying to have the most influence, or they're trying to do something that's not evil per se, but it's like, but that affects how they present certain things or what they present to you. And, you know, to be able to, I mean, it can be very frustrating, right? Because it can leave you a little bit just like dead in the water in terms of like, well, then I don't know what to believe anymore about anything, because how do I know who to trust?
Finding trusted sources is important, but also being informed about the process is important. I was in the news business for a very long time, and I was always very frustrated. I mean, I don't believe I've watched television news end to end maybe this century. Well, probably probably after 9/11, I watched some television news, but certainly in the last decade, because the difficulty is, so I'm a print guy. I was a reporter, and I trust print more than I trust television. Television, I think, has this built-in bias, which is, well, if you're getting your news from television, you're probably a stupid person, so we don't want to tell you anything too complicated. And unfortunately, that kind of has leaked into certainly some print, but also in blogs and things, this idea that we're going to give you the gist of it so that you can say you know, but you're not, you feel informed, but you're not informed. And that is always that's always the danger.
So then how do you combat that? How do you become actually informed?
Well, so what do you want to be informed about? So I'm a local reporter, right? You could go to the town meetings. That's inconvenient and boring. Or you can just complain that the town's being run poorly. But that's irresponsible. And so what I'm really interested in is the responsibility that we're willing to take. You know, a lot of times we're very quick to say, well, the media got it wrong, the media doesn't get it right, bup. What have you done to inform yourself besides complain? My new kind of banner that I'm trying to die under is, I don't think that you should tweet about any representative that you couldn't vote for. So there are a lot of hot button representatives here in the United States on both the left and the right, and people talk about them on social media often. And there's no reason to, unless they're your representative. What do you care what the, you know, congressman from Wisconsin is doing if you're not living in Wisconsin? You know, what is your representative doing? And that is something that you can find out. I mean, it's just inconvenient. And when you – it's better to not watch the news than to watch the news and think that you're informed.
And then, so no, I'm just to on that point, there's an interesting I like what you're saying, because it's like, well, yeah, you're trying to change things in other parts of the world that you don't have much control over, if any. Although there is some argument about, like, you know, the power of online stuff to have impacts across the world, right? I mean, yes, you can, particularly with this sort of, like, this cancel culture movement stuff that's happening, mm-hmm. you can see it's like, it's people from all over the world, you know, piling on to these crusades of, you know, shutting people down or whatever it is. And it's like, yeah, but I mean, you know, firstly, why? But secondly, just, you know, is it going to make a difference on your life? No, probably not. Do you know the whole story about this person? No, probably not. And if you do, then I mean, okay, maybe. But it's like, you're right. It's like people should take responsibility for their own community and their own environment and, you know, see what their people are doing. And the problem with that is I guess oftentimes it's pretty boring and it's less dramatic and it's less engaging and it's not as inflammatory, which is, you know, used to draw in attention and do this and that. But it's like, but that's how you're actually going to make changes and things.
It's right. Absolutely the case. My example is, it's much easier to complain about crime than to ask why your town is so inequitable. Mm-hmm. You know, why don't we have enough jobs for people? Why is it okay for people to go hungry? You know, why is it okay for people to go uneducated? Those are hard questions, and they don't have easy answers, and people's beliefs are going to run up against one another, and that's a hard thing to sort out. It's easy to say, well, crime is a problem, and we have a section of town that's a crime problem, and we'll just put more police there. You know, that's not a solution. That's not even addressing the problem, you know, and
it's a Band-Aid.
Right, and we're looking at we have so many systemic problems that we're ignoring for the satisfaction of being able to, you know, call someone worse than we are. The other thing that I joke about is I have an iPhone here, you know, and many of us have iPhones or we have smartphones. And some child was tortured so I could have this phone. And that makes me a piece of human garbage. And so it's probably best if I find someone who not only has an iPhone, but also does something worse than that, right? Someone who's worse than me allows me to not think of how I'm part of the problem. I can show you who's the real problem. And that is where it gets sticky, because it's so much easier to find people to blame than it is to find our part in the problem and then to make our life more inconvenient so we're less part of that problem.
Yes. I mean, it would be extraordinarily difficult to do that, right?
Yeah.
To do it properly, because you would have to essentially have no part in technology if you wanted to really address the problem. Or you would have to, I don't know, get into all sorts of legislation things and whatever, and you're fighting against billion-dollar corporations that, you know, have teams of lawyers to sort this out so that, you know, that doesn't change because of it.
The other example that I gave, and I want to say it only because of what you just said, I used to write about zoning, like land use legislation, which is easily the most boring thing that anyone could have to do. And it would be me and 12 lawyers in the audience, you know. Yeah. And 3 years later, somebody would complain and say, hey, why is that housing development going up? And I would say, well, I've been writing about it for 3 years, but it's boring as hell to read about housing developments. You just want the housing development not there now, but you didn't want to participate in a way that would prevent that. And also, even if you did, if it was me and one other person and 12 lawyers, you're still going to lose that. And it makes people feel powerless. And it's so much easier to just blame the system than say, wow, I am really impotent and meaningless. Because that's not a nice thing to think before you go to bed.
No. And I suppose it's interesting, because that is also, that leads into, you know, a way to find, because we're talking about like finding people to blame, right? And so if you can blame the lizard people, that's quite a nice enemy to make for yourself. because
You don't have to do anything about
everything.
You don't have to. You don't have to. If they're part of the war between God and the devil, well, then you definitely can't take care of it. You can't do anything about that, and that makes you feel better. You can fight the lizard people by putting out magic rocks, and you're like, all right, well, now I have some control over. Now I'm more important than I was yesterday when I was just a cog in a machine.
And it's interesting because it's like, it depends on how you look at things, right? In terms of personal control and, free choice to some degree and responsibility, because it's like, well, we're part of a collective and, to some degree that gets rid of your personal identity, which we don't really like to think about because it, feels like a personal assault when you feel meaningless or like a cog in a machine. And, to some degree, that's true for everything in life. It's like any given ant in the ant colony is, just one of a million or something like that. And it's like to that ant, that's probably, if it could think about it, it's probably rather depressing, but you don't have to view it that way, right? I mean, there's lots of ways to view it, but it's like, you can view it even in a positive light. You can just be like, well, no, I'm just a particular manifestation of life at this point in time. And, I'm going to have a variety of experiences and some good and some bad. And I'm, not as important as I would like to be or something like that. And that's okay, because it's fine to just, sort of go about your existence and enjoy or whatever it is. Despite its challenges.
And that's I think the closest anybody's ever going to get to being happy. And the idea that there is some happiness beyond that if you just do this one thing is troublesome. Again, that's something there's no evidence for. There's no evidence that you can be happy by not accepting that your place in life. There's nothing wrong with continuing to strive. I mean, I'm continuing to strive. I'm probably going to write another couple books, and I'm going to hope that people buy them. I keep trying to do things, but
of course,
remembering that the doing is what's important, not the result of the doing. That's the closest I think anybody's going to get to being happy.
Right. And it's like, and taking that perspective also allows you some form of more control over things, right?
Yes.
Because you're just controlling your response to things and how you feel about things or whatever it is. And you're not trying to control the world and, shouldn't be happening. Yeah.
Right.
Because I mean,
absolutely.
You're fighting things that are so far beyond, individual power that it's like trying to move planets. I mean, it's extraordinarily difficult. And also unnecessary for you to do. I mean, I suppose if you have some calling to do it, you can try, but it's probably not going to end so well for you. just in terms of it being miserable, not in terms of some like cataclysmic destruction.
Yeah.
It's just like, well, you're going to try and, I mean, maybe you'll have some effect and, maybe that's good, but if it takes your whole life, is that worth it?
Exactly. Especially if you're not getting any satisfaction out of the effort.
Yeah. And I suppose if you are, then fine, by all means.
That's exactly it. It's in the doing. As long as you remember that it's in the doing, you're going to be closer to happy than to unhappy.
Right. So I feel like empathy for people who get stuck in cults and things like that.
Yes.
Because it's like, that's what they're trying to do. And they're just trying to be happy and they're just trying to find answers to things. And they tend to get trapped in places that they can't necessarily easily get out of, right?
What's frustrating about cult leaders like Sherry and others is taking advantage of that. Like that, if you want to find evil in the world, find someone who's taking advantage of someone else's loneliness. Or if someone else's insecurities,
that's evil in the world. And
right.
using for sure. that for their own gain, that is evil in the world. And it's not, again, it doesn't have to be supernatural. It is evil to get someone to trust you so that you can take their money, you know, and crush them, you know, and crush their ideas, not only of self-worth, but of who they are, you know. And what happened to, you know, the Stephen Mineo, who dies on page one of the book, so it's not a spoiler, you know, but that's what happened to him. You know, they took his entire sense of self away, and he wasn't mentally prepared to handle it. And few of us would be. You know, I mean, you do have some responsibilities. If you put all your eggs in the Sherry Schreiner basket, they are going to get broken, and so are you.
Right. So, can you tell us a little bit about the Steve story? Just a brief synopsis of what happened there.
Sure. So there's this guy. His name was Stephen Mineo, and he had a girlfriend, and her name was Barbara Rogers. And Barbara was probably Stephen's first girlfriend, certainly his first serious girlfriend, but quite possibly his first girlfriend. And he was 32 and she was 42. And Sherry told him, Stephen grew up not far from where the World Trade Centers fell. And, you know, he was terrified of it his whole life, terrified of the 9/11 attacks. He was a truther. He was looking for what was really behind the 9/11 attacks. And that's how he fell in with Sherry, probably in about 2010. And by 2017, he was ready to move away from he lived in New Jersey, not far from where I grew up either, but to move from New Jersey to Pennsylvania, where Sherry said he'd be safer from the New World Order and from, you know, coming trials and tribulations, and he could set up a survival camp there. And so Stephen went there with his girlfriend, Barbara, who he said was his wife. They never got married. He just referred to her as his wife. And after they were there for about 2 months or so, almost 3 months, Sherry turned on Barbara and said that Barbara was a witch and a reptilian and a vampire and a super soldier. And Stephen had to leave her.
Imagine being all of those things.
Oh, that's a busy day. That's a busy day for sure.
Yeah.
And so she demanded that Stephen leave her, and Stephen didn't take that well. And so he started to attack Sherry. And Sherry said, well, Barbara is going to destroy you. And after 2 months of trials and just, again, constant attacks from Sherry's people and constant attacks on Sherry's people, one night, he and Barbara were messing around with a gun, and the gun got put to his head. It's questionable whether he put it there or she put it there. Both of their hands were on the gun, and the gun went off, and Stephen died. And Barbara was charged with his murder. And eventually she was convicted of third-degree murder, and that's acting in a way with depraved indifference to human life, which I think may have been a fair, you know, it's tough to say that if you're holding a gun that's against someone's head, you're not acting in depraved with depraved indifference to human life. You know, it's, right. I think the charge was fair. I mean, Barbara had her own emotional troubles, and as did Stephen, but, none of it would have happened without Sherry Schreiner. And as a matter of fact, what I say in the book and what I believe in my heart is that Barbara was just almost like a casualty. Like, it didn't have to be Barbara Rogers, but Stephen was always going to find a girlfriend, and Sherry was always going to try to separate Stephen from that girlfriend. That was one of her modus operandi. She had probably done it to about a dozen other couples over the years. That's how, one of the ways she kept her ministry interesting to people was by occasionally accusing a random member of being with the FBI or the CIA or being a reptilian. And there would be a brief witch hunt, and that person would be thrown out of the group. And sometimes it was a person who was spending a lot of money in the group. You know, it wasn't just, it was a power play that kept people afraid and on their toes. And everyone believed that someone else, everyone believed that that Sherry was telling the truth until Sherry lied about them. And, right. You know, to see this pattern unfold over the course of probably 8 years is really disappointing, you know? It's you feel like eventually you got to learn the lesson, you know, being accused.
So you think her motive for, you know, these things was like a power for, you know, to instill some kind of fear or respect or something.
Exactly. And to make her and to make the rest of the believers understand that they were part of something big, that the devil really was after them personally. And that they were using their right. friends to spy on them, that the devil is using a person's friends or a person's family to spy on them, making it very personal. And that keeps people tuned in. You know, it's like living in a reality show. Someone's going to be revealed to be the spy. Who's the next person who's going to be revealed to be the spy? And as long right. as it's not you, it's a game that you like to play because you believe it. And then once it is you, you know you're not a spy. Like, you know you don't work for the CIA. You know that you're not a reptilian. And then you're like, well, what about all those other people she said were reptilians? And like, oh, that's right. They probably weren't either. But then, like, if you've invested your whole life in believing in this, once that gets pulled away from you, it is really, really hard to recover. I mean, everything you know about yourself is false. You know, everything you've always believed is false. And all those times when people said you were crazy and you were like, well, you're going to go to hell because you just don't know the truth. You know, people left their families. They're like, well, my family doesn't believe, so I can't really talk to them anymore. And then they get kicked out right. of Sherry's club. And they're like, well, I can't go back to my family and say you were right. She was a con artist. All you can do is just live with the humiliation of having been duped for decades.
Right.
And that's not
pleasant. Yeah, I mean, it must be terrible, right?
It's got to be.
And, yeah, it's sort of like, you know, cults can be auto-cannibalistic, right?
Yeah.
As in they devour their own for the sake of the good of the cult. I mean, you see it in political parties and stuff as well.
Yeah, there's a scapegoat cults. When you need one. There's always a scapegoat, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, there's always the idea of sacrifice the one or the few for the greater good sounds good until it's you who's being sacrificed, and then you're like, right. this is not so good.
Right. It's absolutely the truth.
And so you think that Sherry, you'd think that Sherry was not, you don't think she believed in like the kinds of things that she was saying. So she would kind of, like, why would she pick certain people as spies or as whatever it is? Is that clear?
I have an opinion. I don't think it's irresponsible to say, but I think it would be irresponsible to say this is a guess based on some evidence. This is not proof. Here is some evidence. So Sherry had an inner circle, and I think sometimes if someone ran afoul of someone in the inner circle or if somebody said something that someone in the inner circle didn't like, they would say to Sherry, I think this person might be a spy. And then this is complete supposition, but I have reasons for saying it. And I think Sherry would adjudicate and say, yes, this person probably is or is not a spy. And really, I don't know what she would base it on except her mood, you know, and her whether or not she needed them around.
Right, just human
or whether
judgment.
Or not she thought right, or whether or not she thought that she could exercise power over them. Because you don't have to remember because you may not know. No one saw Sherry. There was one picture of her online pictures of her online now. She didn't do anything in video. Everything, she had a Blog Talk Radio show that she did three times a week, as many as three times a week. And she typed on Facebook, but there were no pictures. No one met with her. Few people talked to her on the phone. There were some text messages and some Facebook messages. But other than that, you know, no one saw Sherry. So this isn't one of those kind of, it was a cult of personality without a person. You know, it was her, it was solely her word that these people were living on. So she was kind of allowed to do and say things that may not have flown if she had to meet these people every Sunday at church, for example.
Right.
So she wasn't beholden.
I guess, yeah. And you can
also, she wasn't beholden to them, yeah.
Yeah. And you can, you know, express power from a distance relatively easily, right? But if you're coming face to face with the person, it's a lot different. It's trolls on the internet, you know?
Absolutely.
It's like, yeah, it's all good to say that to them and tweet at them or whatever it is, but would you say that to their face? And, you know, how do you think that's going to go? If you, and it's just a different dynamic, right?
It absolutely
but
is.
So you say that, like, so you said that, you know, Sherry convinced Stephen to, like, leave his girlfriend or wife or whatever it is, and, you know, she had done that with numerous other people. So were these, like, was she having some direct communication over text or calls or whatever it is with these people, or was it more like how specific were her direction?
It was vague. I think what she said to Stephen was, Barbara is a witch and she's going to destroy you. And the idea is just to make him choose her Sherry over his wife. And that was something that she did with more or less success over the years. Sometimes the couple would leave, but there were several instances where the couple would split up. There was this one person who actually left his entire family and went and lived on Sherry's land for 6 months. And then when Sherry... Now, I think I was told on her land, I was under the impression he was maybe more like camping out. I don't think that he was in the house, which is, again, bizarre.
Peculiar.
Maybe, yeah, or maybe he was living in a nearby. But he left Montana to go to Ohio, and he was there for 6 months, and then they had some sort of falling out, and he had lost his wife and his children and his job. You know, and he was just kind of this, you know, wandering alcoholic after it. And as I said, there are a couple of stories like that. And I think that it made her feel better to have that kind of power. I mean, this is a woman who's married to not a great guy, she's certainly more intelligent than her station in life. And I think that, you know, that kind of bitterness is something that she decided to weaponize rather than to, you know, work, rather than eliminate it, she kind of leaned into it.
And as opposed to doing some, you know, sort of self-work and working on your own flaws and whatever it is, go to psychotherapy or something like that. It's like,
yeah, they're not psychotherapy people.
Yeah, I imagine not. Those are the lizards, right? I mean, who else would it be? But what's interesting is that it's like, I mean, this is just a sort of a separate point. It's like, what I find interesting about this group is that it's like all the conspiracies are real you find here. It's not like there's a person who's just saying like, oh no, like, you know, we have reptilian overlords. The chemtrail stuff's nonsense. The whatever, the super soldier nonsense, like all that stuff, don't worry about that. That's not, you know, that's all conspiracy, but this is the truth. It's like, no, everything is true. And it's like almost any conspiracy that you can think of that comes to mind, you know, she'll have some opinion on it that says it's true.
Yes. Right? The only thing that she was against was the flat earthers. She hated the flat earthers.
Oh.
But that was the only one.
How progressive.
I know. Because you said that, I do want to say one of the things that I did with the book was I came up with a song to go with every chapter. So I have like a song list that kind of accompanies the book. And the final one is a song by Tom Waits. It's on a record called Alice. And the name of the song is Everything You Can Think Of Is True.
And so, right. And so since you just said that, I figured I should let you know. I listened to that song a lot as I was, you know, as I was working on the book. I don't listen to music while I'm writing, but, you know, when I was, you know, just out and about, I would just kept returning to that song because that is the heart of what Sherry was getting at, that, you know, you can make anything you think of true if you think of it enough, you know, and if you convince enough people.
Yeah. And so how come you added songs? I mean, you accompanied your book with songs. Like, what was the inspiration behind that?
Oh, it was really just there were three or four songs that I thought went well with chapters. And then this is mildly boring, but I'll go as fast as I can. When you finish the book, you give it to someone and then you don't have anything to do for like 6 weeks. You know, they're putting it together. It's going through the edits and stuff and you're just waiting. And all you can do is think about the book and not do anything about it. So this was all it kind of worked as a distraction. I would hear a song and I'd say, hey, you know, that sounds a lot like this. The song that I would like to recommend. So my wife also, once I started doing it, she had to help me because I'm not cool and I only know about three different artists. Right. But we also did some searches, and the song that I would like to recommend to you and to your listeners to at least check out is by a band called Love Camp 7, and it's called Orgone Box. And it's all about Wilhelm Reich and all about, you know, the sexual aspect of Orgone, which is the magical rock that Sherry's people used as well. So
we'll definitely check that one out. I mean, Orgone is certainly another interesting aspect of it, right? I mean, that extends far beyond her, right? That's a literature in itself.
Is
the Orgone, which is, you know, just like, could you just give a brief account of what Orgone is?
Sure. I'll tell you what many people, even people who aren't with Sherry, believe, that Orgone is an essential energy, an elemental energy that acts as a filter to take out evil energy from the air. I guess that's the best way to put it. Everyone's probably seen them. A lot of times they're glass pyramids. Sherry's were ugly. They were like lumps. But if you think of a glass kind of new agey pyramid, it's not really glass, it's resin, and it'll have a copper coil inside it and some crystals and some metal chips. And this is supposed to focus this ethereal orgone energy that's all around us and protect you from evil spirits and from, you know, 5G radiation, things like that. Right. They do put them, you know, they put them at the foot of cell towers to protect the environment. Was what some people would do. Lots of people. Too many people.
Not the cell phone industries.
No, not the cell phone industry. You know, people who are afraid of radio waves. I mean, this is really literally tinfoil hat stuff. You know, this is the Orgone is the modern tinfoil hat. Although
I used to make big boxes for people.
And having said that, I want to follow that up with there are a lot of people who use it as part of their religious ritual. There are a lot of Wiccans or witches or spiritual or earth-based spirituality people, you know, who use it as part of their ritual. And I don't suggest that they wear tin hats. You know, that's you know, I've been on a couple of witch podcasts and, you know, they take it seriously as an object of meditation. You know, they take it seriously as of an object of well-being, but they don't try to cure cancer with it. And that's the tipping point. Like, once you decide not to go to the doctor because you have enough orgone in your house, you've gone too far. And I think and many, many spiritual people would say that.
Yeah, and I think it's an excellent point, is that, you know, from a ritual perspective, it's like it can be lots of things can be incredibly beneficial, right? Because every time you see it or touch it, it, you know, reminds you of this or that, and you get some good feelings from it, or it keeps you grounded, you know, but it works from an inside out perspective. It's not outside in. So it's not that the rock is doing it to you. It's that the presence of the rock activates something in your mind, that then has some effect on your body. And that's probably very real. Now, whether it's the rock specifically or it just happens to be your ritual with the rock,
I believe that it's meditative. I don't believe in anything metaphysical really, but I do recognize the benefits of meditation. I think you'd be a fool not to say that if you sit quietly and try to concentrate on not worrying for 10 minutes a day, your life is going to get better. maybe the orgone isn't doing it. Maybe God isn't doing it. Maybe the devil isn't doing it. But maybe just the act of quiet concentration makes you feel better. I mean, it does.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this modern day science will agree with that as well. And yeah, and listen, if a particular stone or rock or product helps you with that, go for it. I mean, but as you say, if you think that it's going to cure cancer, maybe we'll think about that a little bit.
the man who invented the orgone box actually died in prison because he wouldn't stop selling them as cures for cancer. Oh. So,
well, yeah, I guess that was a bad choice on his part. Should have just called it meditation boxes, right?
Yeah, well, his name was Wilhelm Reich, and I don't know if he was a scam artist or if he was someone who just believed in something too much to countenance the fact that he could be wrong. So,
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know. I guess we can't really know that. We can just speculate based on.
Yeah. Well, he was kind of a famous psychologist. He was the one who first posed this idea that sexual repression had an effect on your mental health. You know, he worked with Freud. He was like a real deal guy. But once he hooked himself on this orgone, he just believed that it worked, and he actually took it to Albert Einstein in Princeton. And they talked about orgone, and one of Einstein's research assistants like took one look at the box and he said, no, that's doesn't work. That's the things that you say are happening in there are just they're behaving like the laws of thermodynamics should say that they behave. And there's nothing special about this box. And then, of course, Reich should have said, oh, all right, well, I guess I'm going to have to continue to investigate. But what he said was, well, I guess you guys just don't have the tools to measure this yet. I'm going to go out and sell this because I think it cures cancer. And, you know, to this day, there's an orgone institute in New Jersey. I think it's in Princeton where they, promote orgone.
It's interesting. And I mean, you know, I guess to some degree, it's like, well, who knows?
It doesn't cure cancer.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I'll go out on a limb there.
Yeah, I think you're probably safe with that. but it is interesting how people will devote their lives to something like this. And, I'm not one to judge. It's like, I don't know what I'm going to get into at any point in time. And so sort of it's to be seen. And we'll see how it goes, I guess.
Fair enough. But if you start to worry about reptiles, I'll give you a call. Or call me. Yeah, I'll talk you down off the reptile ledge.
I wonder why the reptile was chosen as like the archetypal kind of creature to, you know, make problems with the earth or whatever, as opposed to other kinds of life forms.
Again, it's almost irresponsible for me to answer because I'm sure there's an actual answer. I can tell you what my impressions are. So my impressions are that it's related to Satan, you know, because Satan is a serpent and Satan looks like a reptile. So it's a combination of this kind of, you know, satanic imagery of the evil lizard, the evil serpent, and tied up with this fear of aliens.
Yes.
And for Sherry, and actually not just for Sherry, for many, I hit a button, sorry. Most of the extreme conservative Christian sects, they don't believe in aliens, because aliens imply evolution, and this is the only planet that God made life on. So since there can't be aliens, but they see aliens all the time, they must be devils.
Right.
And
gotcha.
You'll find that conservative Christians, who don't believe in aliens, but they believe in, they say what we call aliens are really demons or fallen angels in disguise. And that's certainly where the reptilians play in Sherry's world. But this idea of lizard people is, it's as old as can be. It's probably as old as archaeology, you know?
Yeah. Listen, and also I guess from a mythological perspective, like when humans were evolving, reptiles were a big fucking problem.
Yeah. So we're afraid of them.
Yeah. And so if you had to create an archetype of like the worst thing for humans, it would probably look, you know, very reptilian, and whether you sort of picture that as like a dragon or a, you know, giant snake or lizards or whatever it is, it's like those are the scary things for us. Not so much anymore, but it certainly, when we lived in caves,
because they're quiet and dangerous. You know, they're not. You know, they're not lions that you can see coming.
Cold-blooded.
Yeah, they're cold-blooded, and they move funny. That's the other thing. They don't move like we expect things to move. Right. So
yeah, and they're very threatening. Snakes, you know, killed a lot of our ancestors.
Yeah.
Big things, flying things. Not those aren't reptiles, but like I suppose, you know, it all comes through in the end. Well, listen, Tony, thank you very much for coming on today. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I think it's
absolute
a fascinating
pleasure.
Topic. And I think that, you know, people shouldn't just believe what we're saying or whatever it is. It's like we encourage people to go out and do your own research and make up your own mind about things and about people. And, you know, we're not trying to just talk shit about Sherry or whatever it is. We're just investigating an interesting phenomenon that's happening in our world near us and just seeing what's happened because of it, right?
Yeah, and taking it seriously. Yeah,
and taking it seriously and seeing what the consequences are, which for some are, you know...
Terrible,
yeah, exactly. And this is exactly what you go into in your book, Dragged Into the Light, Tony Russo. Look it up. I'll put links in the description of the podcast for people to check it out. And yeah, listen, I look forward to talking to you again at some point. I'd love to have you back on. I think there's always more to discuss.
There's always more to discuss.
Yeah. But until then, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you.